If you like listening to Warriors in Their Own Words, check out our other show, the Medal of Honor podcast. The link is in the show description. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll hear from Staff Sergeant Aquilino Gonell. Gonell is an immigrant from the Dominican Republic who served in the Army in Iraq. He also defended the Capitol on January 6th as a Capitol Police officer.
I'm former soldier and a veteran, Sergeant Aquilino Gonell. By the time I left the Army, I left as a staff sergeant. That was my highest rank. Well, initially I joined to, one, to get away from my dad, and two, to pay my education. But 9/11 changed all that, and I find myself being throttled with the fervor of that time, which was being in the military and go overseas and fight and avenge what happened on 9/11. I was transferred like three times before it ending up in the unit that I got deployed overseas with. First, they needed me for a public affairs unit. Then they transferred me to a maintenance unit, then a supply unit. So I ended up with the another supply unit, a quartermaster, the 4-2-4 quartermaster out of New York. Chilton, New York. Immediately after that, and I think summer 2003, I already knew as a person that works in personnel, I already knew that we were getting deployed. It was just a matter of time. And I began preparing for those packages for the service members to get all the legal documents and affairs in place. And making phone calls for the immediate people who were needed to be in the unit to help with the deployment. Then the training that we needed to do, by the time we got deployed, it was in the middle of the winter, snowstorm, very cold weather, training outside in the field to go to a desert type of environment. So it didn't make any sense to me, to us, and to myself. But we did get the call. We got to Kuwait, I think it was February, early February, and we spent about 10 days there prepping to go overseas, to go into Iraq. Half of my platoon went by a convoy, and half of the other half went by air. I don't know if it was luck or how I ended up in the plane, but the mere fact that initially the plane or the C-130 did three maneuvers to evade incoming fire, and it kind of like popped my ears for and leaving me with pain for a couple of weeks. I don't know if you ever been exposed to that, but it was very painful. And once I got there, we immediately tried to find a place within the base. It was very primitive. We were still burning the human waste with jet fuel and stirring it up and things like that. We didn't have a latrine, so we just a hole. And eventually things began to get built up with the engineers and things like that. So it was, in a way, I joke around with some of the soldiers by that time. I look, this is, I mean, you might be homesick, but to me, it's normal because I grew up in the Dominican Republic with certain things similar to those things. The only difference was the wording and the language was different. One Spanish, one English. So I'm like, you might be homesick, but it doesn't bother me. It doesn't faze me. So I was a little more comfortable than they were. We had a lot of sand fleas and camel spiders that they were kind of people were afraid of, and duly so. I mean, those things are huge. And they have a, from what I'm told, is that they eat the stomach of the camels when, you know, that's where they got the name from. But it was a lot of fear, a lot of anguish, a lot of uneasiness because we didn't know what to expect. Immediately, we began to set up the base and run the supply line because that's what we were charged of. I know initially we didn't volunteer. We would not be sent to Iraq to go inside Iraq, but to stay in Kuwait, as I mentioned in the book. But later on, I find out that both my captain and my first sergeant at that time, they advocated for us to go deeper inside the country into Iraq. And because the unit that was already there needed replacement, and I guess we would draw the short stick of the straw. I know I remember when I began the process through the military to become a citizen myself, they did the paperwork, and even that was fucked up because when I actually got to the Social Security office to prove that I was to apply for it, that was the process back then, they told me, oh, your name is misspelled, and both your first name and your last name. So I got to fix two things. I'm like, how can that be? I just submitted it myself, and I double checked, and then they fucked it up inside the Social Security or the Army. And by the time I got to Iraq, there were several soldiers that I knew that they were immigrants themselves. They were either from Jamaica, Africa, the Middle East, and Dominican Caribbean, some of them from Central America as well. And these are people who signed up to fight for this country. And I don't even know whether they knew that was a possibility of them gaining their citizenship. I know when I signed up initially to join the military, the recruiter supervisor mentioned to me, well, are you a citizen? And I'm like, no, I'm not. But I mean, I don't know what that means for you. And he goes to another room, come back, and he with a statement at the bottom of my contract says, if I wanted to continue my military service past 8 years, I needed to become a U.S. citizen. And to me, that was like, I'm already risking my life for this country. That should be outright given to me. But I didn't, you know, I didn't want to get into an argument with him or anybody. So I did follow the process. I know when I was in Iraq, I helped because I already had gone through the process. Somebody mentioned they were trying to reenlist, and that came up. I'm like, okay, how can I help these soldiers? So I went to the battalion commander, I went to the captain and division commander as well, just to speed up the process. We ended up doing, at least in my platoon and my company, we did at least 16 to 20 naturalization. We ended up sending some of these people, all soldiers, to Baghdad for them to be sworn in at the a U.S. embassy at that time. And not only did soldiers from my company, but throughout the base, that word spread out that could be done at the U.S. embassy. And that was good. I felt good about doing that. It helped, like, on one hand, helping all the soldiers become citizens, because I couldn't even exercise my voting rights if I was not sworn citizen, if I was not a U.S. citizen. And I got to do that while in Iraq using an absentee ballot. Whether they got back in time for the election, I don't know. But at least I exercised my right at that time. Once I came back from Iraq, I remember getting into an argument with somebody online, with at that time, America Online chat. People were saying, well, they shouldn't have. I'm like, because they were, at that time there was a topic, you know, about giving the citizenship after they die, post-autonomous. And I'm like, what good is that for the soldier? What is good is that going to be for the family of that person? Because it's not transferable to their family. It's just him or her getting the naturalization after he dies. So their family, I ask out. So I felt very strongly that if anything, should have been given the moment that they go overseas to fight for this country, without even any paperwork being requested. So that was something that I was advocating at that time. And even now, I still do. So even though my MOS said admin, I was doing a lot more than admin think. You know, I was assigned to be the clerk unit person. I was assigned to do guard duty at the guard towers. I was assigned to do guarding the prisoners, enemy combatants coming injured to the hospital. I was assigned to retrieve and gather information from injured people from different companies, including my own, to report back to the battalion commander. So those are things that it took time. It wasn't, and at that time, they didn't even have a lot of phones line going on, or the buses that they had at the LSA Anaconda, which it took probably like 3 or 4 months into it. Everything else was by foot, walking on gravel, ocean, just to gather all that information. And it was hard. It was hard because a lot of people think just because my MOS says, I mean, that's the only thing that I was doing, that I was nice inside a building with AC or anything like that. They didn't even have AC. We were standing in the PX line just to buy Gatorade and M&M's and probably some DVDs at that time just to kill time. Some of the soldiers, they have portable DVD players that we took from here to war just in case we might have a chance to have time. But my platoon sergeant and myself, we were on the LOP PS line, and two or three soldiers came up in front of us and asked, "Hey, Sergeant, can you guys let us go through? Because we are about to leave in about an hour, back redeploying for good to the U.S. We completed our tour, and all we want to do is just buy some souvenirs to bring to our family. And we obliged. We let them go through. And immediately after that, when they were coming out, they got hit. And we feel guilty, myself and my other platoon sergeant. We still do, because that could have been us. They literally took our place, and we got attacked by mortar. There are pictures of that attack at that time. I still have some of those pictures with the wall being plastered with shrapnel. And some of those soldiers were decapitated, injured really badly, and they lost their lives. To this day, I do speak, I'm in touch with my platoon sergeant, that person. And he asking him last year about it to remind me about some of the details, to talk about that incident. That was hard for him and for me as well. He broke down. He still has an image, and this is 20 years later. We're still going through these things. And he has been treated. I've been treated for it. It just did. And those are things that you will never forget. It wasn't a chance by luck. It was just, you know what? It wasn't our time. But the scars and the injuries are still there. So it's hard to forget. It's hard to move on. Yes, I survived those things. You know, I'm lucky, but it doesn't mean that I'm not traumatized by it. The only thing that they used to do was set up the mortars to be fired. Once they set it up and then put the an ice, a brick of ice. And once the ice melts, then that will have fire, the motor. And by the time that the motor, it fires, that person was long gone from the spot. So even if you redirect fire to the same location where the motor came from, that person would have been gone long time ago, because it would have taken probably like half an hour for the ice to melt. And by the time they were gone, I didn't even know that was what they used to call them until last year when I spoke to a very good friend of mine that I still in touch with. He used to be in my platoon. And I asked him, do you remember that time? And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember. Everybody knew him by Motor Mike. I'm like, oh, really? Thanks for letting me know 20 years later. But, you know, as funny as it sounded, it wasn't funny because people were losing their lives and had the potential to losing their lives. We used to send the QIF, Quick Reaction Team, of force to those locations, and that's what we used to find. Because again, you cannot just go to those areas blindly or thinking that it's all clear. So you have to clear the area and then get to the spot. Then Motor Mike used to usually drive around, fire rockets from within the civilian population, and you know, it was hard to catch him. I don't even know whether we did or not, to be honest. All I knew was that they kept firing at us, different angles, different areas, and that was hard. We used to get a lot of civilians. They used to call them Hajis, which is a derogatory term in my mind, and I think to a lot of people. I used to call them nationals or local nationals, because the way they were portraying, like, okay, how would you feel if this was done to us here in the U.S.? How you feel if people that you're supposed to be helping and paying for them for their service, you keep them in the sun all day without no water or food? That's kind of mistreatment. And, you know, I guess because I grew up with that sentiment to look out after other people, maybe that was part of it. But I also knew that doing those things would make them love us more and be more resentful toward our present. And they were. I know that one time that I went to the Abu Ghraib prison, I got there, got them supplies, fuel, food, ammo, and letters, care packages from the loved ones, at least to my detachment that we had there. And once we were leaving, I see outside that this soldier from ours threw the bottle full of liquid to the kid. And I knew we didn't have no Gatorade because I asked. I looked for Gatorade. I didn't find nobody Gatorade. And when I confronted him about what did you throw away, was that bottle of water, full of water, or Gatorade? He was like, well, Gatorade. And I'm like, we don't have Gatorade. What did you put in it? Well, I had to piss, and I pissed earlier, and I filled out the bottle, and I threw it at him, at the kid that was asking for Gatorade. And looking back in the mirror, I see the kid puking the piss. How would you feel if somebody did that to you, to your kid? You'd be enraged as well. So you want to do something to avenge that, you know, in a way. This is their country. We should be cognizant of that and be respectful in a certain way. If you don't need to antagonize the population, because that's going to get not only yourself killed, but somebody else, if not. And I don't know. I just think that sometimes we do certain things because we think we might be able to get away with those things, those impulses, not knowing or taking into account the consequences of those actions. I did discipline that soldier. I did talk to him, had a counseling session with those two soldiers. And I think from that point on, I didn't hear anything more from that soldier. And I hope that he learned his lesson. I mean, I don't know exactly what part of the country he was, but I know he was from the Midwest. You know, as you know, they're not too friendly to people like myself or foreigners. And I just want people to know that if you demonize the community, the population where you're supposed to be working, at some point they're going to fight back, and it's not going to be pretty.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Unfortunately, we didn't know the extent of the plan to attack the capital on multiple fronts. And we thought that the fighting was going to be concentrated just in the West Front, but I guess we were wrong, given the thousands and thousands of people who decided to take part into the insurrection and in the fight. It was a lot of anxiety, a lot of things was going through my mind. We didn't know exactly what was happening outside. Just yesterday, I was listening to some of the radio communication that was happening around that day. And it put me back exactly at that moment where I felt and could feel in the communication the crescendo urgency of the moment when officer screamed, "Send everything you got, send all the officer available." I'm on those lines. We getting attacked. So those are the things that remind me of that moment. And that's exactly what I urge my fellow police officer and my team to hurry up and redeploy ourselves to a position to help my colleagues that they were being attacked on the West Front. And the reason why I say it was worse than Iraq, even though in Iraq I survived explosions and shooting as well, it's not because I'm alive in Iraq and not here. The reason I'm saying it's worse or was worse is because there were things that were happening simultaneously, back to back to back to back. So I survived one what I perceive at that time and on January 6th, a life-threatening situation to get into another one a couple of minutes later, Then, like, for example, we lost the police line and everybody else is encroaching on our space. We lose the police line. We are being overwhelmed, overrun. We are tired. We are exhausted. We feel defeated. Not only are we feeling like we are losing our fight, even though we have guns, we don't want to antagonize the crowd because there are thousands of them and none of them have gone through security. Then people are assaulting you with anything they get their hands on, it, pepper spray, bear spray, breaking down some metal barriers and using those rods to hit you or throw a lance at you or use it as a spear, using the American flag, still attached to a flagpole, and using those as bayonets and injuring you with those things. And not only were we getting trampled, but we also getting crushed in the tunnel. I survived getting dragged like they did to Michael Fennell, you know. Then I'm getting crushed right next to Hodges in between the mob and the police officer behind me. So I'm literally in the middle of it. There are pictures of me just raising my hand, you know, trying to help somebody, but at the same time, I guess I'm calling for help for myself as well. And those are only the first few 2 hours in moments of those 4.5 plus that I spend there in that on the West Front. So it's hard to not to feel that way. And when I say it was a struggle to move 2 feet ahead of us, it was because it was. You literally had to spend almost 20, 25 minutes just to move up a couple of inches forward. And you fighting with these people, and they are relentless. They're not listening to any commands that you're giving them. The chemicals that we were deploying to repel them, that also wasn't deterring them from coming in to the point of even pushing and joining a hee-haw mob inside the tunnel. Regardless who was in front of them, they just want to go through. Now that I know his name and he has been convicted, Kyle Fitzsimmons, he's the guy who was pulling me into the crowd. And it didn't matter to him that there were officers telling him to stop doing whatever he was doing. He joined the fray, not once, but multiple times. And he waited until I was busy trying to help another officer who fell in front of me. And I came to his rescue. I pulled that officer from by the back of his collar. And when I did that, then Fitzsimmons was able to grab my shield and my shoulder strap and kept holding on to it to the point that other riders fell on top of him and he still wouldn't let go. And he injured my shoulder. At that time, I was like, well, let me try give this guy a hit or two, at least in his hand or arm. And if that doesn't work, then I'm going to transition to lethal force. Right immediately when I thought about that, then another officer from the Metropolitan Police came from my right and began to beat him up to the point that he released me. And I was lucky. I was lucky because I could have been dragged just like they did to Michael Fennell. I didn't know him at that time, but he literally took my spot before all that stuff happened. But I already seen what happened to him. He got dragged back in, unconscious, back into the crowd. I mean, into the police line. We, in my opinion, collectively, but yet individually, chose not to use lethal force. Nobody told us not to. We just knew that if we did that, if we did not show restraint, that we didn't know what would be the outcome. And in a way, I think they were waiting for us to use lethal force and we were waiting for them to use lethal force. And that kind of like kept everybody in check in terms of using firearms. But it wasn't easy. I know we were justifiable. If we were to do that, we just didn't know who was harmed, but we knew who that they had harmed, but we didn't know who. And you as a police officer, you are accountable for each round that goes out of your barrel. And if you miss or you hit grandma, whatever, even though you are justifiable, because, you know, there's no way that if there's a fire in a building and you say to yourself, well, I feel the heat, but I don't think it's a fire. And then you get to the fire, you get burned. That's on you for being dumb enough to get to the fire. Because you could see the fire, there's a fire. And a lot of people saw the fighting inside the tunnel, and yet they decide to join the fight, and then say, you know what? Oh, I didn't know that there was a fight going on. You didn't see the punches. You didn't see the pepper spray. You didn't see the brawl. You didn't see the crowd roaring. You didn't see, you know, or the pepper spray or the weapons or the shield be taken away from police officer. So when they go in from the court and say, I didn't know, I got caught up in the moment, or, you know, those are dumb excuses that they only themselves are saying, telling themselves, trying to make the judge believe them. But again, if there's a fight and you think there's a fight and you hear that there's a fight, most likely it's a fight. And a lot of people decide to join the fray, and you know, because it was their intent was to breach the Capitol, and it didn't matter whether we were police officers or not. When I joined the military, I knew the danger of risking my life to protect many people in this country. When I raised my hand again to become a police officer, I did that again willingly as a police officer. And there are certain dangers that are inherent within the profession. And I was willing to take it, and I did. And that's what I thought I was doing on January 6th. When I risked my life, I could have just as easily walked away from that door, that entrance. I didn't. I stayed on my post. I stayed for 4 hours and a half, battling or more, the mob, both outside the plaza on the west front and inside the tunnel. And then we stay over, checking and securing the building throughout the day. I got to the Capitol at 6:10 that day on January 6th. I didn't go home until January 7th at 4 a.m. to be back at the Capitol at 8 o'clock and do another 16, 18 hours, and did that for 3 days. You know, when I risked my life, I wasn't thinking about who am I protecting, whether they're Democrat, Republican, independent, gay, straight, religious, or non-religious. I was doing it because it was my sworn oath. It was my duty. I kept my oath. I did my job. I did what I was supposed to. I defended the Capitol. I defended our democracy. I defended my colleagues. I defended my wife's future, my kid's future, and my own. And even if that meant risking my life, I was willing to do that, you know? And now you have people that say nothing happened at the Capitol. Or let me release this video, this clip, which selectively picks 3 seconds or 3 minutes of quietness out of what? How many hours of fighting? Are you talking about the beginning or the end, when people are being rushed out and people look like they are having done anything? But what about the fighting on January 7th when I was about to head back to the Capitol? My wife, she was upset at me because instead of going to the hospital, I went to work. And I didn't tell her the reason why, but last year, the conversation came up again, and I told her when she asked her, I'm like, do you remember that day? Because you want me to go to a hospital instead of going to work. And I said, no, help me get back to work. At that time, I was not thinking about myself. I was not thinking about my family, my safety, but my family, their future and the country's future. And just Saturday, my wife, I was able to become a U.S. citizen as well. So there goes the irony, or how things works. Back then on January 7th, I thought my family would not have a chance if the outcome would be different. And even if that meant putting myself on the line, risking my life again by returning, even with my injuries on January 7th, I thought that was protecting them and helping secure not only their future, but everybody else as well.
That was Staff Sergeant Aquilino Gonnell. To learn more about Gonnell, check out his book, American Shield, or listen to his interview on our other podcast, Burn the Boats. The link is in the show description. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with the Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.